The OTB Brief. Everything you need to know about sport every morning. Need to get on top of the day's sports news? Well, the OTB Brief is the only sports update you'll need every morning. With all the breaking stories, post-match reaction.
They had one more day to rest. We were really in trouble. Really in trouble to build the team.
And the best bits from off the ball, all in a 10-minute podcast.
Oh, sweaty palms. Of course, you guys know what it's like, but that was nervy.
The OTB Brief, online every morning from 7 a.m. on offtheball.com, the Go Loud app, and everywhere you get your podcasts.
The Off the Ball Podcast Network.
Okay, so the Irish Life Health Mile Challenge is going to set out and see which county and club is the fittest and most active. It's a week-long challenge. It starts on Monday, the 17th of August. It finishes up on Sunday, the 23rd of August, when, by the way, the national titles will be up for grabs as well for the country's elite athletes. But the Irish Life Health Mile Challenge is for runners of all abilities. Get involved. You can sign up free of charge at athleticsireland.ie. And helping to publicise the venture, a man who, I think it's fair to say, knows a bit about running a mile. Eamon Coughlan, how are you doing? Good to have you on the show.
Joe, pleasure to be on the show. Nice to meet you via Zoom.
Yes, indeed. I know you're a big golfer, passionate golfer. Can your knees still take a run? Do you still like getting out and getting a few miles in?
The knees can take the run, but the hip can't, unfortunately. Some of the old war wounds have come back to haunt me somewhat. But while I can go out and walk, jog, no problem whatsoever, it's the afterwards when I sit down on my couch and try to get up from that position is when I really feel it the most. But I'll be good enough to do a mile, I think, on the 17th of August, no problem at all. But I can't guarantee you it will be below 6 minutes, so somewhere between, say, 6:30 and 7:30. But we give it a lash anyhow.
For younger listeners, they will almost, as I sort of knew I was doing already, underestimate your career, you know? I mean, it's a stunning indoor career when you get up and running at Villanova, the whole chairman of the boards. Nickname, obviously, you won the Wanamaker Mile at Madison Square Garden 7 times. 1983, first person to break 3 minutes 50 for an indoor mile, a record which stood for 14 years. I was reading as well, between 1974 and 1987, of the 70 races you were in, on the circuit, the indoor circuit at that time, you won 52 of them at 1500 meters and a mile. 1983 world champion, obviously, in Helsinki, and fourth twice in the Olympic Games. So that is a few races, to say the least. Can you explain to me the chairman of the boards thing? I mean, already the boards is such an antiquated kind of image. Yeah. I know it was at Villanova you first came across the boards. It's plywood, I think, is the type of wood it was. The general sense I get from reading about you over the last day or so is that you were better indoor than outdoor. I don't know if that's your view of it or not. What is it about running on plywood, whatever sensory feel that gives you, that seemed to, I don't know, strike something in you? Or maybe you can explain it to us, because it's a staggering kind of relationship you have with the indoor track.
Yeah, well, the indoor boards are actually just like plywood. It was like 4x1 lengths of wood put together. And I remember, in the November of 1971, I went down to the local shop to have a look at some stuff down there. And one of the lads told me that the boards were up. And on the way back, I said, oh, let's go around and have a look at the boards, which were put up outside. And we got out of the car, went onto the boards, and I start jogging around. And from that moment, even in our street clothes, I just fell in love with those tight turns and the steep banks. It was almost like feeling like a Ferrari racing car going around. Took the tight turns and being able to accelerate off of those turns. And as things turned out then, we trained 5 days a week on the boards. And it was always, you know, lap after lap, 21, 21, 21, 21 per lap. And it just ingrained in you the times and the rhythm and the pace for running on those tight boards, tight turns, short straightaways that I really loved. Mm-hmm. And then when it came to the competition, again, I just loved the tight turns. And as it turned out, throughout the 4 years of Villanova, I never lost a mile race on the boards during those years. And then as it turned out, when I graduated from Villanova, I continued to win a lot of races all over America. And I just developed some kind of relationship with the audience because of the proximity of the boards to the crowd. They were right on top of you. but more important because there was a tremendous Irish following for an Irish kid who happened to be winning a lot of races. And as a result, they were coming out in force. So I felt it was almost like being on Broadway on a stage. You were performing there. And something special about that I got indoors compared to outdoors. Now, as you alluded to, people said you were known better as an indoor runner than an outdoor runner. I won as many outdoor races as I did indoor races, but the only difference is I lost the Olympics, and I lost them twice. And had I won the Olympics, well, the comparison mightn't have been made. But from Zurich to Oslo to London and Paris and you name every city, you know, I was winning lots of outdoor races, but not with the same consistency and the same times as I had achieved indoors.
Do you get more of a bounce off the wood when you're running on it?
You got more bounce off the road, off the wood than you did outdoors. It was a dead feeling. And even though we went from cinder tracks to the rubber tartan tracks, there was still a deadness on each foot strike on the ground compared to the indoors. Indoors was almost like a finely tuned guitar. When you would play the chords, you would feel the rhythm almost in your fingers. When you strode around the indoor tracks, you could feel the rhythm bounce in your legs. And the other fantastic thing about running indoors was you could judge the pace of your race by the sound of what was like the drums. The quicker the drum went, the faster the race was. The other exciting thing about indoors too was if I was, say, in third or fourth place and with a lap or a lap and a half or two laps to go, I began to make a move. You'd hear the audience immediately go, ooh, as if there's something happening. It was Ray Flynn who told me that later on. He said, "Hey man, I always remember when I was in the lead of some of these races and I heard the crowd going, woo, I knew you were coming and I was hoping you weren't," you know? And you got that indoors because of the proximity, as I say, and because of the acoustics that you don't get outdoors.
Yeah, because I read something in Deadspin about you recently and they were saying, here's something you should know about Coughlin. He's a freak. His indoor times, some run on a dizzying 11-lap bathtub are faster than his outdoor times. And for instance, the time you broke 3:50 indoor, and that's a record which stood for 14 years, that was on a 10-lap mile circuit. And so I guess getting into the technicalities of these things, which I'm not as aware of, the more standard size would be an 8-lap per mile track. Yeah. So actually an elite runner could be giving up several seconds. You know, it's harder to do it on a 10-lap track per mile as opposed to 8 laps per mile. But that was quite interesting that you liked almost leaning into the turns, almost kind of using centrifugal force or something almost. Is that how you saw it?
Very much so. Well, I suppose if you put it into yards, the outdoor is obviously 440 yards per lap, whereas the indoor 11 laps is, 165 or 176 for the 10, which makes a huge difference per lap. But what I found more, I was able to use the turns better than all the other guys. And Marcus O'Sullivan was able to use the turns really well, because Marcus used to tell me, years later, Eamon, I watched every move you made on the indoor circuit and how you hug the turn. So if you can imagine the bank of the track being at, say, 45 degrees, I would run perpendicular to the 45 degrees. Whereas someone like a John Walker or Steve Scott, who were a few inches taller than me, they'd be running perpendicular to the floor, which meant that they were getting thrown off as they went into the turn, and particularly when they came out of the turn, whereas I used that centrifugal force of the 45-degree angle to really catapult myself off the turn and down the straight. So I was actually gaining on the turns where they were losing on the turns. And that was just something really, really, really special that I had ingrained into me. And it's funny, when I go up to the National Indoor Arena in Abbottstown and I jog around the track with my grandchildren, I get that feeling of those tight turns that makes me want to really fly around it. It's wonderful.
I know you were famously on the cover of Sports Illustrated 3 times, I think, you know, which as a marker of fame, especially in that era, is a decent marker. So what was your lifestyle like across, say, 70s and 80s? Are you living in the States? Are you making big money being on this circuit? Are you a big deal? Are you a well-known athlete? Are you in the top 100 or 200 known athletes across the States, or am I overstating things? What was your life like then?
Well, I appeared on the stage of Radio City Music Hall the night of 100 stars. So I was in the top 100 sports stars. That was with Muhammad Ali and a few great champions of the world back in America. And I think because of the likes of even Ronnie Delaney and myself being Irish, Madison Square Garden brought an awful lot of Irish people out. And Madison Square Garden was regarded as, and the Wanamaker Mile was regarded as the Olympic, you know, event of the entire indoor circuit. And life for me back then in college was literally just you get up, you eat, you train, you eat, you go to school, you have lunch, you go to school, you go to train, you go to eat, you go to the library and you go to bed. And it was the same 24/7, except for the weekends where you'd still be running twice a day, but you just did a little bit of studying or you just took it easy. And when I graduated from Villanova, I was fortunate enough to have won the NC2A championships, break some collegiate records, and began to make a name for myself. And life for me, after 76, I worked with the Irish Tourist Board. I got a job here in Dublin, and I was living 50% in the States and 50%, say, in Europe. Europe being the summer season where I compete in Europe. And then in the winter, I would train in San Diego and race around on the American circuit. And then from 1980 on, I was living full-time in New York. I was still working for the Irish Tourist Board. I had my wife and I had two children, and eventually four, but I left the Irish Tourist Board because I was able to pursue a career as a professional athlete. Instead of going into work, you know, 9 o'clock or 9:30, getting permission to go in late and leaving at 4:30 to train, I was now able to become a full-time professional athlete. And I trained from home. The track was near my house. The trails in the woods were near my house. And it was just training in the morning, training in the afternoon, rest in between, look after the kids. But it's pure focus on 100% being a professional athlete. And I was lucky enough at the time because I was winning. I was making good money as a professional runner and I didn't have to worry about a job thereafter.
Sounds like an amazing time.
It was great. It was absolutely fantastic. And you don't really appreciate it when you're doing it because it's just, you know, part of nature. This is what you do for a living and you get on with it. But when you think of the limos and the first class flights and all the people running after you here, there, and everywhere, you kind of forget that, hey, this is what the life of a world athlete is.
Well, so, no, it's so the Olympics, like, as you rightly say, if you, and you've said before, you definitely felt you were good enough to win a gold medal, let alone a medal. If you had won a medal at either of those two games in particular, Montreal in 76 or in Moscow, that would be how I would introduce you. You know, that's what an Olympic medal does. It cuts through the noise for the casual fan. Does one irk or did one irk you more than the other, 76 in Montreal or 80 in Moscow?
76, definitely more than 1980. And the reason for 76 was I hadn't lost a race that year on the collegiate circuit. I had just graduated from Villanova. And when it came to going to the Olympic Games, my plan was to just run exactly the same way as I ran all the other races, except I could go from 300, 200, or even 150 or 100 to go. And I never really consistently went from the same spot. I judged it on that particular day, but that was my plan. And then the night before the Olympic final, having won the heats and won the semi-final, Jumbo Elliott, the famous Villanova coach, in his stutter says to me, "Champ, we've got a few fast half milers in the race. If the pace is too slow, I think you should take it out." So when the gun went off, all of a sudden I sit in behind John Walker. I'm back in around seventh or eighth position. We go through the 400 meter mark, still behind John Walker. And I hear 62, 63 being the number of seconds for that lap. And I realize, oh God, the pace is too slow. And I made the biggest mistake of my life right there and then. I went straight into the lead and tried to run the speed out of the other guys. And I became the sacrificial rabbit, if you like. And all I kept thinking about was looking around and seeing where the other guys are, but they weren't going by me. They did what I planned on doing. With 300 meters to go, John Walker tried to go by me and I slightly held him off. And then he got by. With 200 to go, Van Damme went by me. And then Walter tried to go by. I held him off, and then coming down the home straight, I can still see it clear to this day. I moved wide to try and get by the other guys, but I was like running in my sleep. I wasn't going any faster at all to catch up or to get away. And Heinz Wellman, Paul Heinz Wellman from West Germany, just caught me on the line for the bronze medal. And I was absolutely devastated. And it's funny, I saw a photograph only yesterday that somebody had sent out of the finish. Oh, they were congratulating John Walker on some achievement he received in New Zealand only in the last couple of days. And a photograph of the three boys going over the finish line. I was cut out of the photograph, but I could see my foot in the photograph. It was like, oh, Jesus Christ, here we go again. A stark reminder of the frustration and the disappointment. 1980 was a different story. From the point of view, again, I was running really well. I hadn't lost any races that year. I just broke the Irish record winning up in Oslo. I came home, ran the national championships up in Santry, where I won the 8 and the 1500 metres. In the same day after already running fast heats the day before, and I got sick as a dog the next day. July the 7th, I'll never forget it. And over the next 2 weeks or so, oh, I was vomiting and I was in bad trouble. So instead of training, I decided I'd just rest up. Went to one doctor and he said I had the flu bug. Went to the other doctor and she said I had something else, food poisoning. So between the jigs and the reels, when it came to the Olympics in Moscow, I didn't even think I was going to make it. And eventually I did. I decided not to win the heats, not to win the semis, just get into the final. In the final, I ran the perfect race, but I ran out of fuel. On the last lap, I tried to go by Miros Yifter. I wasn't able to go by him, and I just didn't have the energy to sustain the pace all the way through the end. And I think because I knew what it was like to finish fourth the previous time, it was easier to handle fourth the second time. But Dwight Stones, the famous high jumper from America, who won a bronze medal, said to me, "Geez, Zane, I know what it's like." He won a bronze in, I think it was 76, and in 1980 he finished fourth. "I know what it's like to finish fourth," he said. "But to finish fourth twice, that really sucks," he says.
It does.
And get over these things. And as you said...
But do you? So give us, because the honest answer here must be more nuanced than that. And I know you've done so many other things and you've had such a remarkable career, and I even wanted to ask you about what life in politics was like later on. And you've had all these experiences. When, if the answer is yes, when did you manage to really, like, actually park it? I can live with this. This isn't going to be something I'm going to bristle at inwardly whenever it comes up. You know, it's even funny, that photo coming up the other day. It's like, ugh, you know, does that wound ever heal for someone with your talent?
Of course it does. No question about it. You're disappointed for a certain period of time, particularly, I suppose, until you retire from the sport. And then when you see the odd video clipping of that race, wherever it's on, even if it's on Reading in the Years, and you go, "Oh, shit, I was so close, but yet so far." But you move on with it. You know, what would like have been life for me had I won the Olympics since 1976? Or what would like have life have been like if I came back and won in 1980, a second one, or whatever it might be, even a bronze medal? I don't know. Life I got out of athletics has been phenomenal, even up to this very, very, very day. I was very lucky to win the amount of races I won. I was very lucky to travel the world through my sport. I was very lucky to meet numerous people. And I was very lucky with the various things I gained, from financial gain as a professional athlete to my family life. And I look back and I say, I have nothing to complain about for finishing fourth. The disappointment probably remains there, but it's not a chip on your shoulder. It's not like you look back and, you know, begrudge because so-and-so won and you didn't. Or if so-and-so wins a bronze for Ireland in subsequent years, they're superheroes, and someone asks you, "Well, how did you do in the Olympics, Eamon?" "Oh, I finished fourth." "Oh, shit, that was no good, was it?" But if you tell them you finished third, "Oh, wow, you're great." You know, that's all part, completely part. And when I look at some athletes who won Olympic gold, silver and bronze medals, who haven't had the same lifestyle or the same wonderful life and family life that I have had, I put it into perspective by saying, "God damn it, I did well out of my sport with no regrets."
And I guess there is always 1983. I mean, you were a world champion, age 30 in Helsinki in the 5,000 metres. And there was no mistaking your tactics that day. Is that you peak your powers, age 30?
Pretty much it was, yeah, coming up to 31 nearly at that stage. That was kind of my moment of redemption, if you like. And my moment of redemption, meaning I knew I should have been in the medals, if not winning gold medals in 76 and 80. I just had that much confidence in my ability. I knew the other runners. I knew I could beat them. But in the Olympic Games, it plays havoc on your mind. It could play havoc on your body. You could lose confidence just in a race, or you can get ill the days before, like I just said. So when it came to 1983 World Championships, the previous year I was out with an Achilles injury and a stress fracture, and I was gone for almost 9 months without running a step. I eventually went to West Germany, and we found a cure for the Achilles injury at the time. And when I came back running a week later with no pain whatsoever, I decided rather than trying to run 100 miles a week, I'm going to just do 80 miles a week and keep it at that, not run myself into the ground. And if I felt I was getting too tired, an injury might come on, I'd back off. So I looked after myself really well, all the way from September right through to that following August, making sure everything I did on a daily basis wasn't going to make me get injured or get sick. And going into the World Championships then in Helsinki, I knew I was mentally fresh, physically fresh, and ready. And at the World Championships, we had heats one day in a 5,000. We had heats, semifinals this next day. We had one day's rest, and then we had a final. And the night before the final, my agent from IMG at the time said to me, "Well, Eamon, we're going to make your move tomorrow." And I pointed down on the track to the very spot which became the famous park where I clenched my fist and I look at the Russian. I said, "I'm going to move from there." And the next day when I ran the race, I stayed back. I could hear all the commentators probably saying, "What's happening to this guy Godlin? He couldn't do it in 76. He couldn't do it in 80. And will he be able to do it here today?" But I blocked all that out of my mind with the plan to be in contention with four laps to go, the mile, my distance. Now I'm a miler. Now I think like a miler. Now I run like a miler. And I held my cool, despite the fact that Dmitry Dmitriev would have been 30 yards ahead with two laps to go and almost the same distance with one lap to go. And I gradually caught up with him on the back straightaway. And I held my cool, took a quick look behind me to see, was there anybody close? No one close. And I knew then, coming off the turn at that very spot I pointed to the night before, here I go. And it was the greatest feeling in my whole sports career, up to the Masters mile when I retired, because, as I say, it made up for all the disappointments. Now, it was only a World Championship. It wasn't the Olympic Games. But it just proved to me that if I can get my body and my mind right on one day at a major championship, that I'm not that bad after all. Mm. And thank God it didn't work out.
It shows the importance of tactics as well, and even keeping the way you described that race, there's a laser focus there in how you're conducting your business and you're not going to be distracted. And the importance of that can't be understated. We probably don't talk about tactics enough when we're analyzing these races at times.
Yeah. Well, when it came to tactics, not just in that race, but in most races, you visualize these tactics in training. So I'd be training with 10 guys, 15 guys on the track, doing quarter mile repeats or whatever it would be. You'd be practicing getting into a particular place, me at the latter back of the pack, the middle of the pack, or you might be up front. But each quarter mile run you'd be doing, coming off a turn, you'd be looking for angles in the pack in training. How could I get out of trouble here if I was to get out of trouble? How would I make my move up to get out of trouble? So you visualize it, and you also go through it physically for when the actual race comes about. And when it does, you've been in this position so many times in training that you're now experienced and you know how to get out of trouble. And the one area of tactics that's really important is when you're in serious trouble, coming off the last turn, tight onto the bend, you have to take it really cool, because there will always be a gap that will unfold on the inside if you're willing to wait till the final yard, even in the race, to take advantage of that gap that might come about.
I've read an amazing story you told when you were 35 and you'd missed, obviously, the games in 84, which I'm sure was a huge disappointment. And you've one last crack at Seoul. And in your own words, you came close to crossing the line. Tell us about going to see the doctor and standing on the street afterwards with the decision to make about, well, I guess in effect, drugs to get back from.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think of 88 and I think of drugs, you know, that's almost a byword for that, for that game.
Yeah, I wrote about that in my book, All Right, when we started to talk about the use of performance enhancing drugs in sport. And there was all sorts of rumors in the 70s with the Finns and blood doping, and then into the early part of the 80s with some of the Americans out in Los Angeles. And there was talk about human growth hormones, there was talk about monkey hormones. And I was injured at the time, again, with an Achilles problem. And I met with a friend of mine in New York who was working on it, and the physical therapist was working on it. And we began to talk about the use of drugs in sport. And I was saying to the guys, well, you know, I'm not sure. Because if you forget drugs from somebody, he or she would know that they've given them to you. And for the rest of their life, if you've achieved something, they'll always be able to hold that against you. And like, where do you really get them? And with that, the guy turns around and says, hey, Eamon, do you want a prescription? And I go, what do you mean? He says, I'll give you a prescription. So he wrote out the prescription along with another prescription for the cream for my Achilles, and he gave it to me. And I'm outside and I'm at the chemist shop and I have the prescription for the cream, the steroid cream, and I have the prescription for, I don't even know what they were, to be honest with you, right? And I just said to myself, fuck this, excuse my language. And I tore it up and threw it into the bin. And I said, there's no way I'm going to sacrifice what I achieved on the boards, what I achieved in the World Championships, just to try and make the Olympic Games. Before it was different, before I was trying to win the Olympic Games, now out of frustration, I was trying to win the Olympic Games. And I just said, nah, you'll ruin everything in your whole life that you've ever done if you go down that road. And that was it. And I never did it.
Around that time, or in the 80s, was it an open secret? Like when you're over in the States and you're on the circuit and you're talking to different athletes, you think of that 100 meter final in Seoul. Does everybody know what's going on? Like do athletes have a sense of, well, him, her, there's something dodgy there? Or was this a big surprise to everybody?
Well, it wasn't a bit of a surprise whatsoever when you're referring to the 100 meter final and Ben Johnson. And yes, everybody does go, oh, I think he on it, I think she's on it, oh, look what camp they're in. All that finger pointing goes on, but without any proof, without any evidence. And it was always my philosophy, just not to get caught up in trying to question who is or who isn't, just get on with the job and do the business. But when it came to our friend Ben, one of my good mates, Mike McIntosh, who originally was from Jamaica, moved to Canada when he was a young man and got involved in athletics, began to coach. And Ben Johnson was part of his training group when Ben would have been only around 14 or 15. And then Ben moved on to Charlie Francis when he became a later teenager. And Mike, my mate, and I at the Toronto meet, or the what was the other place, the Edmonton Journal, all those American meets were on. We talk about Ben, and we look at the size, the way he's after bulking up. And he'd say, look at his eyes are yellow with jaundice, right? He said, this is the effect that this stuff is having on him. Yet Ben was winning races here on the boards and winning races there. Everybody was pointing fingers and saying, oh, look at this guy. How can he do it? You know, he's beaten Carl Lewis, you know, the most famous sprinter in the world at the time. So when it came to the Seoul Olympics and Ben running explosive heats, explosive second round, explosive semifinals, and then exploded in the final to break the world record, we all go, holy shit. He got away with it until the next day word came out that he was after testing positive. And we were not a bit surprised. I think what was more surprising in that race was the fact that 7 out of the 8 finalists eventually were found guilty of using drugs.
Yeah, that's an eye-opener for everyone. And I mean, you fast forward now, I mean, post London 2012, for instance, it's just been a succession of medal winners having to hand back their medals. When you watch the sport now, because I struggle to take any enjoyment from watching the sport, and it's terrible to castigate everyone. But I mean, I watch any race, and it's how excited can you get when your suspicion hovers over everyone at the moment? What's your relationship with watching athletics now from a doping point of view? Because for me and for lots of others, something, it's been hollowed out, something has been detracted.
Well, I was at the World Championship championships there back in Doha in September, and they were absolutely fantastic. I enjoyed every single bit of it. I have more of a tendency to kind of look back and look at some athletes who might be still world record holders to this day, guys who might be Olympic champions from the past and are still being kind of adored and admired for their fantastic prowess in their sport, and I'm going, you know. I don't buy into that. But I think modern day athletes, it'd be very, very difficult for them to get away with it because they've been tested all the time. And as a result of I was turned off for quite a number of years, but I've come back into the fold now because I see World Athletics and a lot of the other sports bodies are doing their damnedest to try and keep up this testing as much as possible. And anyone who's willing to do that now is definitely going to get caught. It's the past people who are now being caught for their guilt, you know, from a number of years ago. That is what turned me off. But I'm happy enough to say now that I think it's an awful lot cleaner than it was in the early teens and in the noughties and 90s.
You were in the Shannon between 2011 and 16. What's life in politics like?
Difficult. Difficult to get things done. You know, in business or in your sport, you have goals, you have ambitions, you set out your plans, you go about doing them, and you go do them. In the world of politics, you might have plans, you might have goals, you set about doing them, and they're very difficult because there's always going to be obstacles, there's always going to be questions, you've always going to have to prove yourself along the way. And you've also got to build up trust with the people within the civil service, within the departments, and with your colleagues, and gain that trust and gain that friendship. And you've got to kind of play them along until that trust is definitely instilled, and then you might be able to get some kind of a reaction. And I will use an example of my first private members motion that I was bringing to the Shannon back in November of 2011. So I was only in there like 6 months at the time, and it was to do with physical education in schools. And I'd done my research with focus groups all around Ireland and came back with like a 40-page report. And my report, I kept it short because there were dozens of reports for 20 years saying the same thing that I was trying to say. So the night before I was due to debate this in the Shannon, I got a number of sports people and academics to come to the Shannon to present to my colleagues, the other senators, what I was talking about. And I didn't want to get involved in that conversation. I was saying it for the night before. So while they were going through that with some of the people, I get a phone call from the department to say, Eamon, we're going to put 9 amendments to your private members bill. I go, 9 amendments? I said, this is all about physical education. Well, we're going to put 9 amendments to it. I go, how can you do that? This is all about the kids. Well, I said, well, if you change one word, and I go, what do you mean change one word? Well, change one word from calling for action to calling to explore, then we drop all 9 amendments. So that meant to me, that's it. We want to explore a way of going forward with physical education in schools, as opposed to me demanding action, which meant that was going to be pushed down the road more and more. That was the most difficult thing I found with politics in terms of getting things over the line. What I did find also was that my colleagues did work hard. My colleagues, just to even try and get elected into council, just trying to get elected into the Shannon, trying to get elected into the Dáil, is a tough ordeal. It's like a marathon runner training for years and years and years and years to run that race, and you might fall at the finish line. Very, very, very difficult, but it's not in your control. It's in the control of your constituents. That's the hardest part about it.
And what's your view on the Shannon? Because obviously it survived by the skin of its teeth. The general opinion out there, and I can't say it's a million miles away from my opinion, is it's, you know, talking shop, ineffective. It's for aspiring TDs or for TDs who haven't quite made it. And even I was looking, the reforms promised when it survived, Michael McDowell did a report, by the way, the 14th report in 80 years on how we need to reform the Shannon, 14 reports in 80 years. And he did that at the end of like 18 months ago. And basically the most recent information I saw on it was there's been zero action on this reform report. So Michael McDowell went off. These are the reforms. We need this, 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 and this. And still nothing's happened on that, you know, 18 months on. It ties in with your explore. You know, we'll explore and on we go. Do you look at the Shannon and think, yeah, there is a really valuable purpose here it serves? Or having been in there for 5 years, do you think, I mean, really, would any of us notice all that much if it was gone?
We probably wouldn't notice if it was gone, generally speaking. But within politics, you certainly notice it is gone, because the Shannon is there to keep a check on what's going on in the lower house or in the Dáil. So I think it's good from that point of view. And the kind of people who are in the Shannon, not including myself, are academics. You know, they're people of high qualifications in their respective fields, from law to, as I say, academics and so forth. So they're just keeping a check on things and to make sure they keep the Dáil in place. Now, at the same time, that's kind of a bit of hypocrisy, because if the Shannon doesn't pass a certain bill, the House can overrule it within 90 days, after 90 days, and it's going to take event. But politics is all about debate. It's all about opinion, about various issues being raised, being debated thoroughly through, when at the end of the day you come out with some kind of consensus and it's eventually voted on and it's passed or it's rejected. And I just really think it's important to have a Shannon there to make sure that things that are going through the Dáil are going to be well thought out and debated.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.